There's artificial intelligence involved, and we're live. Hey, folks, this is Walt on behalf of the BAMF podcast and the RPG Creator Spotlight. We haven't done one of these in a while because maybe I haven't been excited in a while, but now I'm definitely excited for the latest book coming out from Storyweaver Games. And we have Mr. Sweeney here to talk about it today. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. That's Dr. Sweeney to you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I will make sure I amend the show notes. And he's coming to us from the future because he's 14 hours ahead of where I am. So it made connecting this just a little bit strange, but we managed to work it out. You're in the middle of a gaming convention that you have every few months. Did you want to tell folks about that?
Yeah, we have something that we call either Just JoeCon, which is when I'm running it and bringing the food, or it's StewCon when it's my buddy here, Stew, running it. So we've got about, I don't know, what about 12 people here? People will come and go, eat nachos, drink lots of coffee, and 20 later, okay, it's going to be a big day. And yeah, we just play games, we do some play testing, but mostly it's just a chance for us to, you know, be gamers for a change.
That's fantastic, rather than writing them all the time.
Writing and formal plating is a lot of work, and layout is even more so.
Right on. So a few years ago now, you had the beta version of the original High Space on, and kind of shopped that around, and it made a pretty big splash, as I remember. It was one of those things where it was just familiar enough to stoke your interest, but just different enough to get you hooked. Can you tell the story for those who don't know about High Space, about how that came about? Sure. And how it went to the new version?
Okay, well, it was actually pioneered by a guy called Patrick Taylor. And Patrick, like me, has an absolute passion for the works of, you know, everyone from Ray Bradbury through to Peter F. Hamilton to really Ian Banks. There's a lot of Ian Banks in this. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to create a culture, a sci-fi culture that was had this sort of feel of Traveller, but without that 70s tropiness. And we wanted it to be a little bit dark around the edges. So imagine Star Trek, but with a slight dark satirical edge to it. And so that became the original High Space that was set in only a tiny little part of the galaxy. That was the Lantern. And we just wanted to explore that little space to see if we could do it, basically. That was very successful. Stayed on the top 10 bestseller at RPG Now for close to 10 weeks. It was just huge. And that was always for us almost like a module, you know, a tiny little lens to a much bigger universe we wanted to paint. So that we... You know, wrote a whole bunch of modules set in that setting. And then we started to say to ourselves, how do we actually make the big book? How do we make the big vision? And Patrick said, well, let's do a Kickstarter. And I was like, I'm a little bit nervous of Kickstarters. And I have to tell you, my nervousness was probably well justified. Kickstarters are a challenge. But we did that. It was a successful Kickstarter.
How big was the Kickstarter?
It was relatively small. We only wanted about $7,000. We got quite a bit more than that. But you know, honestly, you don't make money with Kickstarters unless you're incredibly lucky or you've got an amazing pre-existing piece of license, you know, intellectual property, which we didn't have. You know, this is definitely a labor of love. Luckily, we had enough people in the Kickstarter that pretty much within the first half day, it was already subscribed. So everything else from that was just then figuring out how do we move it forward. But part of the problems with Kickstarter that we found was in the fulfillment, we originally had, say, a softcover version and a hardcover version, but we didn't quite get enough in the Kickstarter to really make the cost sense. We didn't know this going in, that to have two separate print runs. So we ended up just doing everyone hardcover. It was actually slightly cheaper, but it ate into our profit margins to do it that way. So there's all these little nuances. The other thing that we didn't really have was a good communication strategy. We, with one exception, we have always been a part-time business. You know, that's the way that a lot of the gaming industry works. But the Kickstarter has enabled us to actually employ some people full-time. Not me, unfortunately, but some people. So there's been a lot.
Somebody needs you as a doctor somewhere, right?
Yes, yes. I make more money than computing, unfortunately, which I still love. I still love educational computing. Love it. So, you know, basically the Kickstarter did give us enough funds to do this really, really right. During that, the book grew, the concept grew from what we were thinking about 140 pages to 200 and something, plus the Terrorborg book, plus all the other agencies that we want to now tease out. And so now what we're doing is we're rolling out all these other bits and pieces that you mentioned earlier. So it's been a lot of fun. It is a labor of love. I love the fact that I can now actually employ some writers to do this work, to work with us, and we can get different voices into it. So we've got a couple of wonderful women who are writing some pieces for us as well, and they just bring a really different narrative to some of this work. And then you've got people like me who loves to, I like to write the crazy weapons tech and the weird archetypes and so forth. So it's a lovely mix of story, narrative, and that sort of more gamer prose. So we're getting there.
Now, have you been able to get out into the woods a little bit with the guys from, I don't know, maybe the Australian Army or local police, and get to play with any of like regular weapons and see how that would relate to how you write the weapons in the game?
No. Although, you know, I have gone, I have to be careful what I say here. I do have a bush property, and we do have to go culling. We've got a lot of wild animals, rabbits and foxes and things that don't belong in this country, and so I have shot them. But I don't believe you need anything more than a 22 to shoot an animal like that. So, no. Interestingly, though, I do quite a bit of work with police forces and on the technology side, and I insist on actually going following them around and seeing actually how they do their jobs. But AusCops don't have nearly as much armaments as, say, our cousins across the the Great Sea.
Right on, right on.
We're not quite as militarized yet.
Well, I've seen some of the wildlife. I would be militarized to the teeth.
Oh, look, the wildlife is not so bad. You just got to be tough. You just got to make sure that you're wearing lots of heavy duty clothing that their bites can't get through, and you'll be fine. And carrying a big knife, you know, a Crocodile Dundee knife helps.
Perpetuating that stereotype.
I'm going to do something.
Yeah, right. Well, I got the High Space book behind me, and I can say from firsthand experience, it's gorgeous. Oh, absolutely gorgeous. How did you come up with the art style that you came up with?
I'm not totally happy with it. There's actually three separate art styles in it. One of the things that I would not be doing the same way next time in a Kickstarter is we did these, vanity plates where people who are at the high level, we had three of them, would get a full page piece of artwork that they will board into the game. And that required, once we got into that, we actually discovered that you couldn't do their faces in the style of art that's in the rest of the book. You actually couldn't do it. So we had to almost do a Photoshop montage. And people who know the book will see those three plates. Huge thank you to the people who you know did back us fully for that. But it does take, for me, it takes us out of the book a little bit. Then we had a guy called Roman who just did a fantastic job of the more illustrated work. And we had another guy called William who we actually found on DeviantArt, and we just fell in love with his portfolio. So I reached out to him and I said, hey, mate, there's about a bunch of your artwork that I really, really love. Would you be prepared to sell us some and do some more work for us? And he went, no one's ever asked me. And I went, what? This guy's crazy. You're like, what? You're doing this for nothing? So anyway, we paid him, you know, the artwork was about a third, a little over a third of the cost of the entire production of the product. So we did invest heavily. I'm a big believer in paying your artists well. And you know, you don't, yes, and you do pay all of them. You do not do things like, hey, would you make me a picture and I'll give you promotion? It drives me nuts. Same with writers. I see that in our industry all the time. So we paid everyone proper except for ourselves. We're doing it for love, but that's okay. So there, you know, as I said, there are three separate styles. So this is some of William's stuff. We agonized over the cover for a long time, and finally it was a non-artist who put it together. The symbol sets and so forth were actually my design. So this is really, as I said, three separate art styles. the general process was for the starships and for that sort of stuff, use the 3D rendered, you know, that lovely 80s art style. But for the characters and the races, go for more of an illustrative style. There you go. There's the one of my favorite characters, which is the Fishman. Every race, yeah, you got every sci-fi has to have a Fishman and a Catman and so forth. That's what people wanted. So yeah,
very Flash Gordon.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we really wanted to be quite tropey with the setting. Nice. The big difference of the setting is that it is very high tech. So, you know, the tech is up there way past the magic level. It's a genuinely, you know, well-meaning culture. It's a nice civilization. But boy, if they encounter somebody who's not being nice, they will make them nice one way or the other. They'll do whatever it takes.
And that's where
Star Trek.
And that's where the wild cards come in. Before we get into that, can you give people like an elevator pitch of the of the Pandominion and what the setting is about?
Sure. Well, I think you get an idea straight away from the name of this galactic spanning culture, and it does cross three arms of our galaxy. Its name, the Pandominium, is clearly, you know, gives you an indication that we don't take this too seriously. There is a dark sense of humor which runs through this. But the basic society is that they have uplifted every civilization, new civilization that this culture encounters. They go up to them and say, hey, would you like to join us? We will give you great technology. We will increase your lifespan by hundreds and hundreds of years. Things will just be better. You'll be at peace. You'll have no problems. You'll have no poverty. Now, if that society says, no, we just want to be what we are, they go, oh, no, you really want to join us. Seriously, you want to join us? Can we bribe you to join us? And if they still go, no, they go, oh, okay. And then, you know, things start happening, like their leaders start having accidents or their crops start dying or, you know, leading all the way up to war. So this civilization genuinely believes it's doing the right thing. But because of this uplifting process, the vast majority, 99.98% of their civilization are very passive. They would not watch action movies because that would be shocking to them. It'd be like us watching Saw, you know, that visceral. They're not passive. They're incredibly creative. They're very literate, but their idea of combat is to have a good philosophical argument. However, a consistent percentage of the population, no one knows why, is born as a throwback, what we call a wild card. And we actually thank Pinnacle for allowing us to use that term. We did check with them. And they're people like you and me. We seek adventure. We have slightly violent tendencies in the back of our head. You know, we all have that. So we're the dangerous ones.
So it's all the guys from Australia.
Yes. I've actually got another game where the guys from Australia are genuinely nutcases, but that's a whole other thing. Anyway, so the Pandominium, there's this hint that the Pandominium itself is being manipulated by another species for some nefarious reason, and that will be unfolded as we roll out all these adventures we've got. And this group of these wild cards do all the things that no one else can do. So it's black ops in space, but it's the other part of it is that Pandominium is now reaching out into parts of the universe where they're encountering things which are genuinely more advanced than them, and they have no idea how to deal with that. They've never encountered that before. So it's a culture in chaos. And the opening of the book series that we've now got, the Lantern Nebula, the main source of their power for their starships, has been quarantined. It's just been taken out of the equation. So they're heading into maybe a war footing, which they don't really know how to handle. They don't have a big standing army. They have an army, but it's a fraction of the civilization. And they're under-resourced. It's the first time in this civilization's 10,000-year history where they're actually facing resource shortages. So Pandominium ensues. I have to say, when I saw the new Star Trek, when I saw the new take on Star Trek, I just grinned from ear to ear, because a lot of what we are toying with, the politics, if you will, is actually embedded in there. You know, this civilization, we're wonderful, we're clean, we're the good guys, but yeah, they're basically still colonial power.
Right, absolutely. Now, what was the design process like for this when you started putting this together? Did you automatically drift to Savage Worlds? Did you say that this is how we had to do this?
Yes, pretty much so. We've got a couple of different product lines. We love Savage Worlds. We're big Savage Worlds junkies. One of the guys over here is going, no. He's our dirty hippie gamer designer. So we've got other product lines which are dirty hippie gamers. 1993, called Rules Pack. I don't know if you heard that.
A little bit. Yeah, I caught it.
But you know, I disagree with him. I think he's wrong. I do like the Savage Worlds because it does suit well for high action, pulpy, you know, that style of game. It pushes up into the supers, and it also allows you to go down to some grim and gritty if you want. But it's not, you know, it balances somewhere between narrative and the more crunchy games. So that works for me. On top of that, Savage Worlds books sell more than our indie games, and it's just, you know, independent indie pieces of work. While they sell relatively well and there's good margin on them, Savage Worlds sells really well. You know, it's just a great piece of IP, and it's a great system to write into. So then what we said is, okay, what do we take out of the Savage Worlds setting that we need to change? And we try and change Savage Worlds as small as possible, as little as possible. And the reason for that is really simple. It means that anything that we write can be taken by other GMs and repurposed. So we've actually had some companies who've taken, for example, our first generation Starship combat rules and put them into their space setting. So rather than them design it, just take ours. We have no problems with that. It's part of that community spirit. And it's what makes Savage Worlds really, really powerful. So pretty much our design process then became write the thing. Patrick Taylor did a good chunk of the writing. We each have different writing skills. Patrick is very good in writing, if you will, the rules out. I'm very good at writing more the wild, crazy ideas. Shared Google documents, everyone arguing with each other, piling on that. Increasingly now, we knew that we needed other voices in our writing, so we needed more, quite frankly, we need more drama in some of the adventures that we're now writing. So, you know, we've got other writers coming in to bring that in. It's about behavioural modification. Is what you're saying.
About incentives and modifying behaviour.
And writers and
not
writers.
It's about simulating reality. That's the wrong way.
I don't know if you guys can hear that.
Yeah.
That's the dirty hippie gamer. I actually think it's really, really important that you do have lots of different viewpoints and attitudes coming into the game design. And then you just negotiate as a team what works. Ultimately, we spend huge amounts of time playtesting. And when games are playtested well and they're fun to play, that's the ultimate design. That's really what matters.
Now, how backwards compatible is the second edition of High Space to some of the stuff that you were releasing before, such as like you have the ship schematics, right. Into the Remnant adventures and stuff like that?
Yeah, so Patrick did change substantially the Starship battle rules, and that's caused a bit, you know, some people really like the old ones, which were more simulationist versus the more cinematic rules that we've got in this system. Honestly, you could plug and play either, and they can stand alone. So there's a lot of compatibility. In fact, the adventure series that we're currently writing, we've developed a 12-part series called The Paradigm Shards, which is set in this wild sort of cowboy zone, which gives the players when we finally publish it, if they go through that, they'll get up to a good, you know, seasoned or even veteran level, they'll be able to go back into the lantern. So what we're now writing is Into the Lantern, which comes back and revisits that part of space, which has had something very, very, very bad happen to it, which is why it's been quarantined by this godlike race for the starfish. So is it backward compatible? Absolutely. Can you plug and play pieces of it either suit out? That's the beauty of Savage Worlds. You get the ability to do that if you design core to the Savage Worlds system. So, yeah.
Right on. And how has the Savage Worlds community received the game so far?
Look, largely positively. I actually think that it's more along the lines of Savage Worlds, because it's got such a pantheon of different types of games. You can play anything from low life, which I love, all the way up to, you know, I would say High Space is sort of somewhere in the middle, up to, you know, really wild out there games, I would say, like Flash Gordon. I think Flash Gordon's fantastic. I've written a game. We haven't published it. I wrote it a few years ago, and then we put it back on the shelf, which is effectively a Hong Kong action movie game. I spent 20 years in Hong Kong, and I love those movies. Savage Worlds is perfect for it, but boy, you have to be way out there on the edge of adventure, you know, superhero nuts environments to actually do those well. So the community has done well. Every time we publish a new piece on RPG Now, we stay, you know, in the number one slot for at least a week, which is incredibly humbling, actually. We've got other games that I desperately would like to bring out and publish, but we're so busy writing more stuff for this setting because we've just got such a demand for it. We actually can't keep up with the demand, and that makes me sad. Makes me sad.
Well, there's the happy side of it too, that there is such a demand that that people are really scrambling for it. And that that brings me to the intervention agency. Can you tell that English is my second language? So
you're American. That's okay.
Yeah, that happens. We saw hints of this book coming out last year, where you were kind of teasing it around, and now that it's hit, really, really fun product. Can you tell us a little bit about how this came about?
Sure. So it was always planned. We actually put it as one of the stretch goals. We didn't make that. But as a result of that, I'm really glad we didn't make it, because originally it was just going to be like the Terrible book, which is, you know, 48 pages, 50 pages. This one is a bit bigger, but it's far denser. And one of the things that we picked up from some of the people who were talking about the original High Space book is there weren't any archetypes really in the core book. We had always planned for those to be in the supplements. And they said, we want archetypes. So we went absolutely gonzo on the archetypes. We knew that so intervention is the black ops. It's actually an agency that does not technically exist in the hierarchy of the Pandemonium. And it is run by one of the minds, these self-aware information systems that have emerged out of this massive, you know, utopian communications network. But the mind which is running it has no name. No one knows what it is or who it is. Just between you and me, it's actually the clone of Machiavelli, basically the manipulator, who cloned itself so that it could forget about itself and do all these operations so that it itself could have own deniability of itself. So basically the entities who do the work of this intervention agency, they include things which are, you know, almost like Terminators, killing machines, down to folks who have drone swarms, and everything in between. It's very, very out there. And at this level, you're really starting to play effectively superhero-type characters, but replacing superpowers with technology, either genotechnology, cyber technology, or whatever else that comes with that. We've got a lot of packing going on there. No, they lost. The building burnt down, killed them all. Oh, my character killed them. Yeah, you see, that's what happens when you go on a break. But I'm really excited. So that book is now, we're actually struggling to get a decent print copy of it done. I'm hoping we have a lot of problems with Lightning Source, a lot of problems with printers. Not Chinese printers, unfortunately. Lightning Source gives us grief. But the next product that we're currently working on, we've finished the Paradigm Shards and writing and getting the artwork done for that. That's this campaign book. We started writing that to be a plot point campaign, and typical of us, we just kept on writing. So it's currently coming in at just under 100 pages of a campaign book. It will shrink down. And that then leads us into, once they've finished that adventure, that leads us into another campaign, which is actually going into the Lantern and finding out what's happening. And that's going to be very much a military survival, it's military survival story. But the other book that I'm working on at the moment, which is really exciting me, is the Tactical Field Guide, which is the military handbook. And that book is absolutely Joe Sweeney written all over it. It's just, you know, the zaniest high-tech weapon systems that we can imagine. We've got characters who have suits that actually will inject fat directly into their skin when they put them on to prepare them for cold weather environments, and just nutsoid stuff like that. So weapon systems that are semi-sentient, everything that you can imagine, the furthest tropes of sci-fi, we're pouring into that. But we've also developed, and that has been written now by one of our new writers, a four-part mini adventure series called Hector's Heroes. So think Reg Dawn with cadets, but from an ultra, you know, with incredibly powerful weapons, but totally outnumbered. And it literally is, you know, your planet has been invaded and you're the only people who can save the day. Quick, get the civilians to work with you. Oh, what, you mean they've already been genetically conditioned so that they abhor violence and will collapse like rabbits in the headlights? Or you better deal with that. So it is literally, you know, there's so many, it's literally Red Dawn. You know, it starts with the sun turning red, which it does every 60 years, and everyone leaves because it's lots of electromagnetic radiation. It's absolutely Red Dawn, but it works just so well. It's a really, really fun adventure to play. So that will take us. We tend to find it takes about 6 months to get these from initial writing into production. Game designers, it takes a lot longer than people realize. But I'm looking forward to that one too.
Nice. Nice. Now, with the line spreading and with bringing in different authors, different styles, how hard is it to now go from I'm working with my partner and we're doing all the writing and the art direction and this and that, to now you have to be more manager than writer? How has that affected everything?
Not too hard for me. I've run businesses, had small businesses, and some fairly large businesses all through my life. So I semi-retired about 10 years ago. So that works well for me. And I have no problem giving up creative control. It's really interesting. I talk to some other people, you know, who design games, and even some of our own writers, and they'll send a request out to an artist to do some work, and then they'll constantly tweak the artist, going, no, I want this change, I want this change. And the artist at the end goes, it's just not worth it. No. When I deal with people, I think the right way, and we're getting this through the whole culture of our group, is let them do it once, let them do it right, because they will have a vision. Their vision is no more or less valid than your vision. So if an artist gives me a creature, we've got a creature in the core books called the Bok Po, who I always imagined as Kung Fu Jedi pandas. You know, that's really what they were. But he drew them up. We haven't published this one yet, but he drew them up to be almost like a Wookiee, like a wild, crazy sort of Shinto Wookiee. And I went, you know what? I'm okay with that. There's nothing in my writing that does not deny his vision. I'm happy with his vision. And so you need to take that. You need to give up being right about the vision of what the game is. At the same time, when we are designing the early stages of a game, particularly with the dirty hippie gamer over here, Stewie, we have huge, and this is where the playtest comes in. You have huge amounts of backwards and forwards, and we literally get on a hangout like this. There might be three or four of us, and we've got the document on the screen, and we're all editing each other's work. And that's okay. You've got to have that level of trust. Now, the new writers that I'm bringing in, they've never worked this way before. And it does take some time to bring people up to working that way. It requires, certainly some writers get a little bit, you can't change my work. I can't be wrong on this. This was my idea. No, kill your darlings, cut it back, get it crisp. And that works very well. The other thing that works really, really well for us is we've got two fantastic editors. Ray Duell is just probably the best editor I've ever worked with. He's also got the most evil horror writing mind I've ever encountered. But that's a story for another day.
Excellent. When we're talking about the intervention agency, you were saying how, you know, this is like the Black Ops community of the Pandominion, and one of the things I liked about the High Space Core book is that you get this sense of flavor right from the beginning pages, because you're like, hey, before you jump in, you guys need to know how everybody talks around here. Here's all the slang. Here's all the this. Yes. Here's all the that. And it really immerses you right away and kind of gives you that sense of flavor. And one of the things I liked about the Intervention Agency Handbook was that you have things broken into sectors, but each sector has its own handler. And when you're looking at these sectors, you got the descriptions and stuff like that, but it's really kind of like the handler that stands out for each sector and gives you the flavor. Can you talk a little bit about coming up with something like that?
Well, I think that's just straight out of really good writing. If you read a book and it is just all about the plot and the characters really are just names and they drive the plot forward and nothing changes for those characters, that's a boring story. A world comes alive, any narrative comes alive when you recognize that there's people there because people are telling different parts of a story. And in fact, in a really good book of any narrative, I don't hear the gamer over there saying flashback scenes. Yeah, absolutely. When you can draw those characters in, what happens is it's the interactions between minds that matter. And in a really good story, when you deconstruct them, there's this wonderful concept called the seven key elements of a story, storytelling. It's got all sorts of different ways of talking about it. But basically, a story is really a deconstruction of something that we individually are interested in. It's a moral, it's a way of looking at politics, it's a way of looking at a dilemma, it's a way of fulfilling wishes. And all these different minds, therefore, that you have to have it. So if you actually look at the way most of our games are constructed, but in particular High Space, we spend a lot of time talking about the interactions between the civilization and the people who drive those interactions. So the fact that we've got these minds, they're not AIs, they're self-aware information systems that have emerged. That is literally our way of saying the Pandominium is a character. It has a real character in the game. And then that goes all the way down to the granular level where, in fact, some of the toolkits that you've got have personalities. The starships have personalities. Because once you do that, everything is story. Everything is that rich, rich story, not just plot. I have to say, though, it does make writing a traditional adventure series much more difficult, which is why I brought in some other writers who are journalists and writers of and have a fiction background to bring in another perspective. We want to make this even feel even more, I wouldn't say the word human because most of them aren't human, but you get the idea. It's got to be drama. That's what I'm talking about.
Right on. Absolutely. Now, who came up with the names of your agency archetypes? Because some of these are fun. The one I had the most trouble with was the Remoderator.
Remoderator. That one wasn't mine. Remoderator. Yeah, the Remoderator was Ray, our editor. There's a lot of language play in all of this series of books. In fact, there's even more coming up in the Paradigm Shards. We've got names of cultures there that are clearly references to other pieces of literature. We are shamelessly plundering all the great stories of humanity for this, as all good games should do, in my opinion. But yeah, the Remoderator is an interesting one. I know that Ray, we argue, I was originally called him a drone boy, but they go, no, let's call them a Remoderator. It's like, yes, that's the one.
I like Synth Forcer. That's mine. Yeah, that's a personal favorite.
Yeah, that's your Terminator.
Terminator's
brain in a box. Terminator.
Now, you got the old saying now that whatever dog you feed the most is going to win, and you know it's usually a reference to personality. You know, you got your little black dog and your little white dog, so forth and so on, right? But in using that old saying and putting that into context with High Space, what do you use to feed the dog that drives the creativity for High Space? Do you watch a lot of movies? Do you do novels? Do you even have time for that anymore and just draw from old experiences?
We actually had a conversation about that the other day with some of our writers. And we literally said with the Red Dawn episode, I was drawing an old Red Dawn. And I said, go and watch old Red Dawn. Go and watch, you know, and then go and watch the Will Wheaton and go and, you know, just go and watch all of these things. And so we explicitly state to each other, go and watch X. This conversation the other day was there was another writer coming on in, and she is wonderful. She's actually Jay, our full-time. She's not the strongest writer, but she's our full-time hire. She does everything. She's wonderful, and she writes fantastic characters, and she writes the most strangest ideas. So we were talking about she's writing a series of new civilizations, basically a civilization handbook. It'll probably be a freebie for the, you know, for the fans. But short, sharp ideas of little civilizations that are weird that you might encounter. So think of it as a, you know, 36 civilizations to screw up your brain. she's been working on that. And one of them, we come up with the names first, and I think it was something like the Insecto something or other, Morocracy. It was just something stupid, or the Hive or something. Anyway, she said, oh, I want them to have spaceships that are giant insects, that they genetically engineer these spaceships that are giant insects. And I said, oh, you got to watch Lex. He goes, what? I watch Lex. So we actually trade, we trade source material between each other. And when you're open to doing that, it's when it's fun. By the way, have you ever seen Lex, L-E-X-X?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Now, I have to explain to this wonderful Filipino woman what Lex was. And she's just going, and being careful about it. And she's just going, oh, yeah, I want to watch that. That sounds like, you know, that sounds like my sort of show. I'm going, Jay, go for it. So I don't think we will actually have a Lex role-playing game as part of the High Space universe, but there's no reason why you couldn't. So I think the key to actually finding a source, to feeding the dog, is to have a team of people with different skills, different viewpoints, different histories of narrative that they have found, and share those ideas and argue with them and debate them. The positive of that is you get some absolute fireworks. The negative of that is that we have at least half a dozen games sitting on the shelf that were pretty much fully written out that we'll never publish, because they were just either a little too out there, or they just fell flat in actual multiple gameplay test sessions. Their lifespan was too short for replayability. And so, you know, you can have wonderful, wild, crazy ideas and you get in them and you figure them out, but game design takes a long while. It's not that agile, shall we say. So you can spend a lot of time invested in writing something and then decide at the end of the day, nah, not doing that. And my Kung Fu game was an example of that. It needs a lot of work. And I just put it back on the shelf for 3 years and said, nah, we'll park that. My favorite genre, but not everyone else's favorite genre. So
you let me know if you need help. I know both Kung Fu and weapons very well.
Ooh, I see some weapons behind you. It's like, yeah, cool.
Yeah, well, those aren't the weapons I'm talking about.
shooty weapons.
And getting along those lines, I have a lot of friends who are still in the military. I myself am no longer in, but a lot of friends that are still in the military, and you know, you get to talking and knowing people, and you start sharing interests and ideas and stuff. And I said, oh, you know, I said, you know, I was reading this book for this series I just started reading, which of course, High Space. I'm like, oh, they just came out with a new book, and they got this great thing in there that I could see happening in the next 20 years: drone swarm.
Oh yeah, and well, that's already happening. It's being demonstrated now.
Yep.
Yeah. Everything in science fiction is hyperbole of what we can perceive. When you try and take that out, you know, 15,000 years in our future, yeah, it gets. In fact, the drone swarm tech was a really interesting one. When it was originally designed and the rules were written up by Ray, I had to gank them way back, because somebody who has the level of drone swarm with an AI built into it that would be possible in this world setting would just destroy anything on the battlefield, you know, that is a traditional rifleman. So it would destroy the fun of the game. That's the hardest part. It's not thinking of what is possible. It's actually thinking about what's possible and playable. It's a little bit like Battlefield Psykers and Warhammer 40K. That could be a little bit, you know, game over, man.
You kind of get that sense of what's possible and what's playable in a lot of games, because you get, for example, several years ago they had the interview with Keith Baker about the setting Eberron for Dungeons and Dragons, and he was saying, you know, if magic was readily available, why would you develop technology? You know, and it's the same thing here. You know, if you have swarms of drones that can do much more damage than a platoon of soldiers, why would you need the platoon of soldiers? And, you know, if that's the case, why are we sitting at this table playing platoons of soldiers and rolling dice? So, yeah, that's
gotta be ogre.
That's got to be quite the balancing act when you're designing a game like this. What kind of sessions do you have, like, back and forth? Like, does it get super technical? Do you guys, like, pore over technical manuals of drones and start thinking about that?
Interesting. In my job, I do. I'm a big chunk of my job is futurism. So I do look at that. In fact, we poured that into this game. I don't know if you've seen this one, Rapture. And that's the second edition book that's going to come out soon. And then the Confucius. And now this is as hard sci-fi as you can get. There is nothing in any of the Rapture universe, with the exception of the FTL, that is not possible. And then we throw the Rapture into it. Then we actually throw the end of the world. But of course, because they're such a high-tech world, they don't know what's happened. But even the economics and the futurist world building and the predictions of what happens with, say, the US, Russia, and so forth, this was all predicted on a 600-year line, using economic modeling, using socio-political modeling, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, you can. I love going down that rabbit hole. That's something I do in my career. Does it make a fun game? Not unless you throw the Rapture in and then make everyone starting to try and kill each other and become monsters. So, you know, that's the balance. It's one thing to have reality. It's another thing to engage in the story. And if you look at pretty much any even Tom Clancy novels, deeply rooted in tech. But at the end of the day, who are you rooting for? You're rooting for the hero. It's always about the drama, the human element. So for me, there's a big distinction between high space, which I would call science fantasy. Not quite up there with, you know, the Star Wars science fantasy, but it's definitely magic, but explained with technobabble. Same with Star Trek. Whereas Rapture is very, very, very hard tech. All the way down to, you know, what happens if you start shooting ballistics in a low G environment? What's going to happen to you? You put on a space suit. People think that you just pop on a space suit and it's nice and, hey, you can move around and go in space. No, these things will tear your skin off. They have to pressurize you. So we look at that stuff, but then we don't get carried away with it because we still ultimately want to tell a story.
Right on. With a lot of the videos coming out of places like Boston Robotics and stuff like that, you guys must be like geeking out every time something hits YouTube.
It's funny because I actually get to see some of that stuff for real. I love my job.
So you get to talk over robots over picnic tables and stuff?
I've been known to do something similar. I'm a little bit more gentle because I'm worried that they'll push me back. I'm an old man now. But the stuff that really excites me is actually not the physical robotics, but the software robotics that we're generating. And I know that there was a huge excitement just last week with what Google announced. It's not new. They've been building components and demonstrating components of this for quite some years now. But what we're seeing, for example, I've got an ex-colleague of mine who's built an AI about 10 years ago that does translation. It's doing translation far better in what we call in genre. The technology in this space, what we don't realize that's happening is we're not only getting huge increases in power every year and a half because of Moore's Law, we're also getting the benefit of Metcalfe's Law, which is the networking, you know, all of this stuff coming together. But on top of that, some of the new algorithms that now become possible because of this just totally change things. We're talking 80 times speed improvements or improvements in AI algorithms, which are basically statistics, in the space of less than a year. And that seems to be continuing. So I talk about, you know, changing workplaces, the future, and the sort of jobs that will change and all that sort of good stuff. And we ain't seen nothing yet. There's a downside to this, which we do explore in the Rapture universe, which is we're heading to a society where it's really going to be hard to find a full-time job. So there's going to be a lot more people playing games, maybe. Maybe that's the growth in the board game market. Maybe it's right there. But, with all of this incredible advances that we are seeing right at the moment, at least as big as the changes that I saw when we moved from mainframe computers to mini computers and then very quickly to desktops, we're seeing a change which is significantly greater than that. And that will be in the software that we we don't know is happening in the background.
That's pretty wild. And speaking of tech that advances, you know, anytime you have any type of Black Ops crew, you always have to have memorable ships. And we have a couple inside of the Intervention Agency Handbook.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about those.
and some gorgeous, really gorgeous maps. These could easily be printed and put across a game table to be used as set pieces. Can you talk about the design of the ships and what prompted these particular ships to be included in this handbook?
Honestly, I love drawing maps. It's one of my hobbies. I love doing starship maps. So I run a master mapping channel on the Story Weaver website. Had it there for years and years. I just really am fascinated with getting things on the table. So those maps that we have, you can actually, when you buy the set, you actually get access to a very large set of tiles for those ships, which we've actually broken out as 8x8, so you can mix and match them. And we've got a lot more of those coming up. So part of it was I just love doing maps. But the second part of it is it's good to have, because in the high space universe, the ships do have personalities. They are characters. You can actually play a ship and its drone in whatever form. So we wanted to give opportunity to delve into that a little bit more. My favorite of all those ships is the drill ship, which wasn't my idea. It was actually an idea from Pat. And it was basically the idea is, yes, help us, help us. We are a poor little mining ship that, you know, has become lost. Can you help us? And so, you know, who they want to penetrate goes, oh, you're sure. When they drive up to them, they go, latch onto you like a giant lamprey and just drill into you and board you and take you over and do whatever it is that Intervention wants to do. You know, they don't play fair, these guys. So we had a lot of fun with that.
Nice. Now, have you been able to print the maps out at full size and lay them out at the table yet? Have you?
Sure. Yeah. So I've designed them. In fact, it was really interesting. As soon as we published the game, we said it comes with, I think it's like 148 pages of printable maps. A couple of people said, oh, can you put these into Pod for us? And I was looking at that and I went, yeah, not really. I mean, we could, but it would not be cost viable. You might as well print these out yourself. So they were designed to be printed as 8x8 layers. And in fact, I've designed them in such a way, and I do have a tutorial on how to do this on the website. I've designed them in such a way that you can actually take each of those 8x8 tiles and make the ship that you want on the table for your minis, or you can mix and match them. And again, that's just the gamer in me saying, you know, why limit the GM to just what you think they want to play? I believe that games, the best games are the ones that have staying power are modular. You take what you want and then you run the story that you want and you take the handouts and you run those. So absolutely, you can, you know, those are designed to be printed out. But about 10 minutes after putting that up, somebody wrote to me and said, I've just got this. Can you give it to us in VTT? And I went, oh, dumb. So I just re-rendered all of them in virtual tabletop level so that you can mix and match them on your virtual tabletop too. So no matter how you play, you got some maps there. And we will be having quite a lot more of those because they're just fun. They're good collectibles.
Absolutely. And speaking of virtual, have you had any virtual players mixing into your group as you were playtesting?
Yes, we do. We've certainly had some folks. We do a lot of our playtesting internally because we're in Australia, so everyone lives a million miles from everywhere else. but we don't have the networks, unfortunately. That's always a problem. But yes, we do run games. We also go to occasionally things like Aethercon, and we'll run a game there. It's funny. I actually find that virtual tabletops for games where you've got maps on the screen, I don't actually feel it works as well as getting a map on the table, getting the player handouts. There's something visceral, something joyous about physically getting together with each other. But interestingly, some of the dirty hippie games that we've got, like Deniable and some of these other lighter games, they play really well, really, really well online. But I guess that's more a matter of play style than anything else.
Right on.
We are seriously still looking at what would it take for us to take the entire high space system and put it into Fantasy Grounds.
Oh, really? That would be awesome.
That's a significant investment in time and skill sets that we don't really have. So we have to look at that more seriously. A lot of people have said they would love it, but would it be economically viable? And that's, again, the other problem with being an indie gamer like us. It has to be at least break even.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for something the Intervention Agency Handbook is sold right now, you get all those extra maps. It's really great for something like Roll 20 as well, because you can just upload those right into the game and use them as is, which is really fantastic.
Thank you. Yep, and we did design them so that you can bring them as tiles and make your own ship, or you can just bring it as a single map, bang, and just it's designed at 50 pixels per step and all that stuff. So yes, so we can do some things right occasionally.
Which hopefully will mean that we'll get the Intervention Agency Handbook. I can do this English thing. Hopefully we'll get that handbook soon in a printed format and get that out to everybody, because, you know.
I'll know this week. I'm waiting this week to see if the latest print issue comes through. Again, one of the problems of being an Aussie designer is you send it up to the print and it will take them 2 months to send it back to you. It's tyranny of distance. It can be a problem. Not always that long, but occasionally it has been.
Right on.
But we do know people didn't want to wait for it anymore, so we said, let's just launch.
The last thing that I love talking about, and I'm an art junkie because I love comics. I love RPG design. You know, can you talk about the cover a little bit? Because the cover is very evocative. That's
really funny. I have to be honest. This actual starship was from photo stock. And that's what totally blew me away. So we had this beautiful, William, this fantastic designer, great ships, and we tried different covers. And finally, Ray just said, I want it to be a big space gun. And I said, oh, I've seen one of those. So we actually had a clue of this. And so we looked at it and we mocked it up. So it was a non-artist who mocked this up.
Nice.
And we just all looked at it. We put it out to the community and they just said, that's the one. So even though we had spent literally thousands of dollars on all this other artwork, this cover, which is the iconic cover, was actually one of the cheapest pieces. This one cost, I don't know, $100 or something. So it's so 70s style, and it just absolutely worked for this game system. And then we've got other art in here, which, is like this, which I love, the gateway. Yeah, you got to pay your art as well.
On the front cover of that one, which I know, the other one.
Oh, sorry, which was that one? Oh, Rapture? Yeah. Oh, yeah, so this is one of our favorite new pieces of art.
Gorgeous, yeah. Absolutely gorgeous.
And this particular book is, I did all of the art interior for that one. So that one is a very different style. That's very grungy and horror and, ooh, your soul's going to get taken by Satan. Ooh. not taken by Satan. You're going to give your soul to Satan, because you can't actually... You might be being tortured to death, but that's okay.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of being tortured to death.
No.
Especially by Satan, unless it's the guy from the Lucifer TV show. He's...
Oh, my God. I love that show.
Right? So much fun. Was the Intervention Agency Handbook the same in terms of the cover? Was that also Stark Art as well?
No. So that one was, I'm just trying to remember what the cover looks like. No, that was actually William's piece of work. And I love that one. That's the robot one. That's a gorgeous piece. So pretty much all the art in that one is William's work or Roman's work.
Yeah, that very, very evocative. I think my favorite piece of the book actually is, the gentleman, it looks like a guy, and he's got a glowing red on his back, and he's looking at what looks like either a derelict starship or a fallen fortress or something like that in the snow. And I just thought to myself, that just sums up
sci-fi being adventure.
Being
out there on the edge alone. Yeah. What I like about the Intervention games that we've played is you can actually have them as fairly small gaming groups. And I like that because, as few as two players and one GM, because there is the capability for these people, like a good spy movie. They're the outcasts, but worse, they're the outcasts in the worst part of the universe. And that loneliness and that you're incredibly powerful, but yet everything around you is even much more hostile. And that was the sort of imagery that we're trying to get with that.
And that comes across perfectly in that piece, because even though it's such a nice piece, it's very big, meaty, weighty, and it's just vague enough to let you fill in certain details with your own imagination, the character in it is very small. So you get that sense of, I'm one man against everything, but everything is so big.
Yes.
You know, yeah, so that...
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and that was actually one of the challenges that we had with the overall design of this was one of the big debates that we had when we were really going to the design of the Pandemonium and everything that was going to stem from that. What is the role of the human? And so many of these science fiction shows, the human is the outcast, the small one. They're the underdog, not in high space. We decided to be very, very explicit that the humans would be gloriously, like in Star Trek, you know, the big race. There are two others that join them. But at the same time, they're very technically advanced. Not quite as technically advanced as the Terraborg, but they do stand on their own. They're crazy. And the reason they're crazy is explicit, because we've got these two brains. We actually have two brains. We think it's one, but it's two brains. No other species has that, except for maybe the starfish, but more secrets. and you know, what does that mean? We are the outsiders in our own head. And you actually see that subtly in a lot of the work throughout this, you know, it is human centric, but by all means, play an alien, play the Kung Fu. My favorite of the aliens is actually the Po Bok, which are the Kung Fu Jedi pandas. I love them.
Do you have, the testing groups that you have you had a lot of aliens, or does everybody want to play that twist on a human?
That's a good point. Actually, usually when we play test, we do it at cons. So we've got a couple of cons that we go to, because the great thing with cons is that you get very different players, some who've never played before and others who are deeply into the Savage Worlds systems and everything in between. And it gives you the most important thing for playtesting is not so much the character design, because you can design characters. In fact, one of the things that we do know sells really well, or helps us sell books, is put lots of characters in them. It goes back to that early conversation. So we do pre-gens. But it's really important that you play test every possible permutation on a theme. And that's what you get by going to a con and playing 11 straight sessions of the same game.
People you never
want to
play with,
except yeah, so that was a great comment there. There's people you never would want to play with, except when you're playtesting. That's who we try and get. And then, of course, we do push out the games. We've got a couple of people in the High Space community, fans, who we will actually now open up our draft documents while we're writing them. Google is fantastic for this collaboration. So we're actually getting some of the players' input even as we're writing the stuff now, especially as we go to the adventures. Again, you want to make these things, you know, you want to honor the fans. You want to get their input, but you also want to give them something that they wouldn't think of themselves. And so it's...
Right on.
It's... Playtest, we've got games here like The Rapture. I spent 3 years playtesting that before the first edition. We're now into second edition about 10 years later. We don't try and hurry the games, and we have no problems with killing them when they're not right. That said, not everyone likes the same sort of game, so playtest with as many people as you can. There's many permutations on that.
And speaking to as many people as you can... how can people get involved in like the High Space community? What are the best avenues to do that?
That basically come to the Facebook site. I am probably one of the worst people in the world with social media, only because every time I open it up, I start reading things about politics and just start crying. I don't want to think of that. I'm too old. We went through that once before. I don't want to do that again. But no, seriously, just write to us at jsweeney at storyweaver.com or grandmaster at storyweaver.com, or go to the Facebook group. So we have I guess it's Facebook/storyweaver games. We also have a dedicated High Space page as well, so you can get on there. That's really the best channel. We find that's the easiest channels to communicate with. And just talk to us. We are very open. We love. We do get pretty regular commentary from our fans. The fact that we went much more heavily into the archetypes, even more heavily than we originally were planning, in the intervention book was directly from feedback from people saying, I want more of this, or you didn't give us, actually it wasn't, I want more of this, is you didn't give us enough of that. So, you know, okay, you want some more of that? Let's give you some more of that. We did a survey recently where we reprioritized our adventures and what we were writing, which is why Field is going to come up, and everybody wants more weapons tech. They want that craziness. They want those explosions. They want a Michael Bay movie of a game.
Everybody wants a Michael Bay movie of a game. They just don't want his movies. unless you're in China. What was your favorite piece of feedback during the design process? Like something that just made you feel wonderful after you read it?
Wow, that's a good question. That's really weird. I actually can't answer that because I was so busy looking at what wasn't working, and you know, viewing this for how do we improve it. I guess that's one of the challenges with a lot of people. We don't actually know how to take compliments well. We just go, oh, thank you. I think the biggest things is when people actually write to us and say, I ran this game and it ran like this. This is what I did. When they tell us the story, Ricky's video. Yeah. That was for a different game though. One of the people we've got a game called Deniable. It's a comedy game. And he did a little review of us. It's from Let's Level Up. And he basically said, yeah, you made my wife cry. You know, it was just, she had tears streaming down her face. So I guess the best is when we have people after the play tests or who write into us just saying, this is what we did and it was wild and crazy. That to me says we've been successful. The feedback on things like art and game designs and rule designs and you change the ship combat system, we take all of those on board and we do listen to them because those are, okay, how do we improve on that next? One that's an outstanding issue, Gonzalo, who's been one of our biggest fans, said to us, hey, you guys have never told us how much fuel a ship burns up. Because in the Pandominium, when you're playing in the main Pandominium, it doesn't matter. But when you're playing in the Fringe Worlds, this is important. You can get stranded. I was like, oh, wow, Ricky, you're absolutely Gonzalo, you're absolutely right. I now have to create a whole formula for how starship fuel gets consumed. And we've never actually looked at that. That's what I look for. Actually, that gives me probably as much joy as the feedback on what's gone really well for people.
Right on. Absolutely. Well, we're reaching the bottom of the hour. If somebody came to you and said, tell me High Space, what's the one thing you would tell them that you know would sell them on it?
Okay. Imagine an evil Star Trek where the society has the best intentions for all of existence, for everybody. As soon as they meet people, they say, come and join us. But if they don't, they start really dropping shit on you. You're the people who do the shit dropping.
I so need to quote this.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Where can
but
people...
it really is. It is really wild. You know, we use the tagline "Wild Cards Protecting the Future," but it's actually just doing all the dirty jobs no one else can do.
There you go. Absolutely. Where's the best place to pick up High Space products? Is it at StoryWeaverGames.com?
Look, I actually recommend you go to your game store and ask them to get it because we're really trying to push into that. Would help us, but it also helps your game stores. I cannot oversell the fact that game stores are still the heart and should be the heart of our hobby. These are people who commit themselves to it. So buy it through them. If they don't have it, they can ask. They can order it in pretty quickly for you. You can buy it from the StoryWeaver website or you can buy it RPG Now. We don't really mind whatever works for you. But my preference is go buy them in the shops. If you're only wanting the PDF, sure, come to us. We do have a PDF guarantee. If you buy the physical book, you can just take a snapshot of your receipt and we will send you the PDFs and all the other, we often ship the PDFs with lots of other, you know, maps and resources. High Space itself came with, at least for the Kickstarters, came with lots and lots of digital resources for your digital gaming table. So yeah, we stand by that 100%.
That's fantastic. And once again, the next product that we should look forward to is the Small Adventure Series. The shards.
So yeah, we've got the Paradigm Shards, which is actually going to be it's 11 full adventures plus some background of what's happening in the Fringe world. So it's actually become quite a big book. So I think it's going to be substantially larger than even Intervention. That's been written. It's in editing now, and I'm getting the artwork produced for that now. And then the next one after that, I hope, will be the military guide, because you're going to need the military weapons to go into the Lantern. The Lantern's a real crazy place at the moment.
So we're going to have stuff like tanks and missiles with artificial intelligence that can
fly. And psionic mechas.
Oh, you just sold like 3 books at least. So, and I'll buy all 3 of them.
Awesome. Fantastic.
Yeah, that's awesome. I can't thank you enough for taking some time out of the game day to come and talk to us. And we really appreciate you, especially when we're such disjointed in terms of the time difference and the different time zones. So, and I'm sure there's probably something in the backyard there that can bite through the long pants you were talking about earlier. So, you know, taking considerable personal risk to come and sit in one place and talk to us. We're so I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Brian. Cheers.
And please go out, buy High Space, get the Intervention Agency Handbook immediately, and support these great guys with their great games. And for Banff Podcast, this has been Walt, and we'll see you next time. And I think we're out.